change people's association with the chore of ironing as something that is like a beauty routine, caring for your clothes, and really elevate the purchase that is an iron. And launching online allowed us to do all of that.
I'm your host, Dave Knox, and this is Predicting the Turn, a show that helps business leaders meet their industry's inevitable disruption head on.
Welcome to another episode of Predicting the Turn. Today, we sit down with Courtney Toll, who is the CEO and founder of Nori. Courtney, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to meet you.
Oh, likewise. I'm looking forward to the conversation. So diving in on that, Nori is iron spelled backwards. Can you walk me through what led you to say the space I want to go innovate in is the ironing and steaming category?
Yeah, the decision to innovate in the ironing and steaming category was very much inspired by a personal pain point. So I had just started my career in New York City, first corporate job, and obviously wanted to make a strong first impression. But like many New Yorkers, was living in this tiny New York City apartment. And I'd wake up in the morning with wrinkled garments, and I didn't have the space in my apartment for an ironing board. I hated this leaky steamer that I owned from Bed Bath & Beyond, and I couldn't afford repeat dry cleaning. So I would wake up and try every do-it-yourself hack to remove wrinkles from my clothing. And this put a spotlight on a pretty big market that is ironing and steaming that really hadn't seen any innovation since the introduction of the steamer in the 1980s. So we set out to create a solution that was designed for an urban on-the-go lifestyle that was branded and sold direct to consumer. And that solution would end up becoming our hero product, the Nori Press.
So a lot of people have the idea of, this thing needs to be better. But going from this thing needs to be better to how do I go build a hardware company and figure out supply chain and all the stuff that goes into it, that's not simple to go after. So where'd you get started and how did you tackle this world of building a new hardware product?
You're right. Hardware is a super capital intensive industry. Being a fairly risk averse founder, I actually stayed in my corporate job for as long as possible to get the company to a place where I felt it deserved really a full-time employee and later my co-founder as well. So basically, while still in my 9-to-5 job, I was doing a lot of research on other hardware brands. I was speaking with other founders that I had reached out to try and understand where to get started. And in turn, ended up interviewing 19 plus design firms to find the right group to build this next generation iron. We ended up with a group that had engineers that had worked with the Conairs and Remingtons and Cuisinarts of the world, and also started to do a little bit of fundraising before I ever left that first job. So was meeting with family and friends, friends of friends, and ended up closing $300,000. And on the day closed via a convertible note, ended up quitting my job to pursue this full time. But I think sometimes taking smaller, more tangible steps to start to de-risk a venture before you leave the safety of a paying corporate job really makes that entrepreneurial jump a lot easier.
So I want to dive in on that one, because a lot of times you'll hear people say, you must not be all in if you're not quitting and going after this thing. But it was actually, I think, in Adam Grant's book, The Originals, they said that you actually have a 35% higher chance of success.
Wow.
If you start something while you're at the current thing you're at.
Yeah.
How did you balance in your mind as you talk to investors about this? I have this idea, I believe in it, but I'm not quitting my job right now to go do it.
I think the way I thought about it was I was doing a service to all stakeholders of saying, I am not going to spend too much time on this or have you invest money until I feel really confident that this is worth pursuing. And so much of what I was doing while I was still in my day job was starting to de-risk the opportunity in understanding what is the revenue stream of this venture? How big is this market? How do we enter it from both a distribution and branding standpoint? And so I really thought about all of it before I ever collected any money. And I could say, this is how far I've taken it. This is the plan that I'm going to start with on day one with this product development firm when I leave my current job. And all I need is the capital to fuel it. But I have a very clean path to market now that you can fund. And so I actually felt as though this de-risking opportunity that I could take within my existing job was actually a great benefit to the people that ended up investing in the business.
You mentioned that path to market and go to market. When we think about irons as a category, it's been somewhat of a commodity business. It's the Bed Bath & Beyond, Walmart, Target. You go buy the iron that doesn't look a whole lot different than anything else. What led you to create the first digitally native and believe that this could be a play on e-commerce, not just big box retailers?
Part of that same de-risking process was sitting down with a lot of consumers to understand what they were looking for out of a potentially new type of iron or steamer. So we sat down with 500 plus consumers and just heard the same narratives echoed time and time again. People had a really hard time naming brands within the ironing and steaming space. Almost all of the shopping was happening in big box retailers, like you mentioned, and this was for a generation that was now starting to shop a lot more online. And the biggest thing was that no one had any attachment to this product that they really should be using on a weekly or even daily basis. So we knew that by launching direct to consumer, one, we would be the first ever digitally native iron, but we would also have an opportunity to really educate people about what it was that we were creating, why it was innovative. And like you said, Nori Iron spelled backwards totally changed people's association with the chore of ironing as something that is like a beauty routine, caring for your clothes, and really elevate the purchase that is an iron. And launching online allowed us to do all of that.
With that in mind, even though the name of the business really directly connects to the original category, you've begun to elevate the brand as a clothing care brand. So how have you thought about where you want to go, what the category could evolve to, and what your roadmap would look like?
So our work definitely did begin with wrinkles and this one product category that is ironing and steaming. But I think the almost immediate success of the Nori Press started to indicate that there was this really large market that is clothing care that was so fragmented and so dry in terms of the brand that we're navigating it. And I think what really stood out to us was that, one, people were excited to care for their clothes, but that all of the products that were required to care for their clothes were almost considered separate categories. So the clothing care market is almost $90 billion, but it's made up of all these different product categories that you're buying from different places. So you're buying your iron and steamer from one place, you're buying your sewing machine from another, you're buying your laundry detergent from another, your hamper comes from this place, your hangers come from this place. There was no one company that was providing the consumer with all of the different solutions required to care for their clothes on an ongoing basis and do so in a really innovative, thoughtful, and branded way. So now when we talk about Nori, we talk about this next generation clothing care brand creating innovative solutions designed to increase the longevity of your wardrobe or really transform your laundry room. So since the launch of the Nori Press, we have now launched a fabric shaver, a deionized ironing water, and most recently, a laundry hamper.
Talent is a big part of predicting the turn. And as we talk about talent, I wanted to mention one of our sponsors, Hunt Club. Imagine the power of the best marketers in the world helping you to find your next marketing leader. That's the power of Hunt Club. Hunt Club is a new category of talent company that powers the network of experts, connectors, and business leaders to help you find the best talent. Let's face it, recruiting hasn't changed with the times. Hunt Club is changing the recruiting game by leveraging technology and crowdsource referrals to find you the best people possible for your company. Stop paying job boards that don't work or recruiting firms that recycle the same active candidates. Partner with Hunt Club.
As you thought about these new categories and the growth for the business, you started as digitally native. You've now gone into Nordstrom and Container Store and Bloomingdale's. What was it that led to that shift to start thinking about omnichannel for the future of the business?
So D2C we felt was super important for brand building. So we always wanted to launch online and really communicate the values and benefits of both our product and brand in the hopes that Nori would eventually become recognizable on retail shelves. So even though we did launch direct to consumer, the plan was to always go omnichannel. And I think today's market is really rewarding a more omnichannel approach. That said, we started to have a lot of organic interest from buyers because Nori was starting to gain traction and start to become this really cool, branded, innovative player. Buyers from Nordstrom and Bloomingdale's and the Container Store started to organically come to us. That said, the business is still 90% online. My hope is that as we continue to expand and start to even approach mass retail, that our retail sales start to dwarf those online numbers with the hopes of it eventually becoming a majority of our business.
When you look at a hardware brand, you know, that getting somebody over that purchase hump and that trial is always such one of the more difficult portions of it, especially for a product that is, for the most part, being used in your home. So others aren't, they're seeing the result, but not the process. How have you thought about driving trial in, let's call it alternative channels like hospitality, to get people exposed to this great new product?
I think that's one of the best things about initially being digitally native is exactly to your point. You need to demo a product like an iron. You need to see it work. And so because an iron is such a demonstrative product, we were able to create so much content that not only compared the Nori Press to existing market solutions, but also showed the Nori Press in use and created this really satisfying, reel-like video that just showed consumers as wrinkles slowly disappeared with one pass of the Nori Press. And that led to really efficient acquisition costs out of the gate from a direct consumer standpoint. And that's why I think then people are more willing to go into a Nordstrom or a Bloomingdale's and pick up the Nori Press because they've seen it work. But to your point, transitioning that then to someone that meets Nori for the first time in a wholesale or a hospitality ecosystem, we spend a lot of time trying to drive consumers back to the online experience. So we rely on things like QR codes on packaging or in-store demos to still have that same online experience, even though you're initially interacting with the product in real life.
That makes total sense. So you look back on the journey you've had, you're only coming up on the 30-year anniversary for the business. Looking back, what would you have done differently as you think about that first journey as the founder?
I think really taking one channel at a time. When we first got started, I did know that we wanted to be a direct-to-consumer business, but I was still itching to be omni-channel. I wanted to get into hospitality and gyms and retailers and wedding registries. But I think that I would encourage myself to really stay focused on direct-to-consumer. And I do think that is something that we ended up getting right, even though those other channels were perhaps a distraction along the way. By really getting direct-to-consumer and getting the content right from a paid acquisition standpoint, starting to build an online community on Instagram, starting to do co-branded partnerships, which brought credibility to the brand, it allowed all of the channel expansion that was to come to be very natural and organic, and for buyers to come to us and already have buy-in and want to make this a success within retail. So I think taking one channel at a time and ensuring success in that first channel and really understanding what's working in that channel allows you to be successful in whatever comes.
You know, relate to that success that you've had with it. When we look back to digitally native, a lot of the original digitally native brands were in, let's call it, slightly less innovative categories, places where your co-manufacturer could create pretty easy, straightforward product, and the innovation was around the brand and the go-to-market and everything else, not necessarily the product itself, which led to a lot of copycats. You chose to enter a category that is a lot higher barrier to entry for how you go about it, how you build it. What advice do you give to entrepreneurs that maybe are looking at that higher barrier to entry category, but also are somewhat intimidated by what that means?
Yeah, to your point, I think it is super important in today's day and age to create something truly unique. And I think one of the best things about starting a business in a high barrier to entry market is the question that you have to ask yourself. There's a lot of time, there's a lot of money that might have to be invested here. Am I creating something truly unique? There's no doubt that our market is currently oversaturated with brands. And often there was a time when you could just create the same product, put a cool brand on it, sell it direct to consumer, and be considered really innovative. But with something like hardware, you are challenged to really think through how is this different, to pursue patents of something that's totally innovative. So I always say to founders, when you get started, immediately ask yourself, what is so different about this? If I was to explain this to a new customer, why would they choose this product over something else? And then once you do that, think about how to generate revenue around it. What channel is going to lend itself to this type of product, and where do I get started? And do a really good job at succeeding in that one channel, and then I think the other channels will start to open themselves up organically.
So related to that, you have a business that's done double digits in revenue, or more than double digits when you look at that. What have you chosen to do from a fundraising, and how have you chosen to finance the business versus other options that you might have gone off and used?
So hardware is something that we knew we'd have to fundraise for out of the gate, but it is also a category that I think investors have a lot of fear around. Because it was so hard for us to close money, I think it forced us to take a long and hard look about how our unit economics operate out of the gate. So all in, we've raised just under $5 million to date across three different rounds. We started solely with angels, where I think I was trying to find people that connected with that initial pain point that I felt. And then by the time we had proven ourselves in the direct-to-consumer channel and early proof in some retail channels, then we started to get venture capital firms involved and eventually recruited VCs like Yeti Capital, Rachel Zoe Ventures, and Cosmic Ventures. That said, because we weren't able to close always what we set out to close, we were really conservative in how we were spending our money. We've chosen to keep a really lean team and invest everything back into marketing and revenue generating activities. So we did reach profitability as of Q4 of 2023. And understanding how a business operates profitably not only is super rewarded by the market right now, but I think is the best thing you can do as a founder, given the variability of what might happen in the fundraising world.
With all of that in mind, you've had a pretty amazing 3 years of growing this business to the eight figures that you're at now. Where do you want to take the business over the next 3 to 5 years?
There's so many tangible goals I would love to reach. Launch an X retailer or launch X product, reach X in revenue. But I think it just goes back to our original goal. The laundry room is a space that has been traditionally overlooked for the longest time. And when people want to start caring for their clothes the same way that they're caring for other things in their lives, my hope is that Nori becomes the default brand to do so.
Courtney, it's been a pleasure sitting down and having the conversation. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your busy day to do so.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like the show, hit that rating and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And for more resources, head over to predictingtheturn.com.